Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Can you all hear me? No, you can't. Okay, hold on. Let me. Is that better?
Yeah.
Right. Well, my name is Roham Alvandi. I'm an associate professor in the International History Department here at LSE. And first of all, let me welcome you to our second annual LSE Gulf History Lecture, which is hosted by the Department of International History with the generous support of the LSE Kuwait program. Before I go any further, can I just take this opportunity to thank my colleagues in the department and also my colleagues in the Kuwait program for their continuing support of this annual lecture. Our speaker this year is Professor William Roger Lewis, the Kerr Chair in English History and Culture and Distinguished Teaching Professor at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Lewis is one of the world's foremost historians of the British Empire. He is perhaps best known for his work on the process of decolonization in the Middle East. But his work is by no means limited to the Middle East. He's worked on many different regions, many different aspects of the empire, both conceptual and empirical. But I think it's fair to say that he has influenced an entire generation of international historians that work on decolonization, and I proudly include myself in that. I won't embarrass Roger by going through the very long list of his achievements, accolades, publications. You will be familiar with many of them. I would just say that he was elected a Fellow of the British Academy in 1993, and he was made, I think rather appropriately, a Commander of the Order of the British Empire by the Queen in 1999. He is, I think it's fair to say, an American historian who has dedicated his life to understanding Britain's imperial history, and we are honored that he accepted our invitation to deliver the annual Gulf History Lecture tonight. The subject of Roger's lecture is the British withdrawal from the Persian Gulf, which of course you know took place in the context of Harold Wilson's Labour government's decision to withdraw east of Suez. This is, I think, a very timely and appropriate subject for a lecture, given that in October this year, the Foreign Secretary, our current Foreign Secretary, Mr. Hammond, inaugurated the construction of a new permanent British military base in Bahrain, the first such base that Britain has built in the Persian Gulf since the withdrawal in 1971. And that decision has been a controversial one, and it seems to me that Britain has perhaps forgotten many of the lessons of the imperial past, and now more than ever perhaps we need to revisit, re-examine that history. And so it is in that spirit that I ask you please to join me in welcoming Professor Lewis to the LSE.
Thank you. It is indeed an honor to be at LSE. I should say again, I have lectured here before, and I think the last time was in the time of Donald Watt, D.C. Watt, who chaired the session. And in the process of my giving a lecture, I noticed that he seemed to have fallen asleep. This was quite typical of Donald Watt. In fact, it was an affectation to put the lecturer off guard, because he suddenly came to and asked some very pointed questions. So he hadn't been asleep at all, but it was rather disconcerting to think that the chairman of the session had been so bored with the subject that it caused him to lapse into somnolence. My purpose will be to discuss the wider context of the British withdrawal from the Gulf. More specifically, I will explain the end of the British Empire in southern Arabia and its critical link with the withdrawal from the Gulf in 1971. To begin, I will comment briefly on the wider context of Southeast Asia, since we are dealing with the 1960s, and especially the American attitude to British withdrawal in view of Vietnam. But I also want to put forward several themes, which I hope include a couple of original points. The first is that the withdrawal from the Gulf culminated in what I'll call the second transfer of power. The first transfer of power, of course, was the classic case of the documentation of India and Pakistan in the magnificent volumes edited by Nicholas Mansour. And to India and Pakistan, of course, should be added in this first transfer, Ceylon and Pakistan. The second transfer of power included all of the former British colonies and other dependencies granted independence between 1960 and 1971. In other words, all the way from Nigeria in 1960 to the Gulf in 1971. One theme in the concept of the second transfer of power is that of federations, a mixed story of success and failure, success in the case of Malaysia, Nigeria, and above all in the Gulf, failed cases in the West Indies, Central Africa, and one of the main points of my talk, Southern Arabia, now part of Yemen, but which was known at the time as Aden. And I choose Aden as a theme because it helps to explain the outcome in 1971. And not to give too much away, the state of Oman played a critical part in 1970. Until then, for virtually the entire decade of the 1960s, the British outlook was exceedingly pessimistic, at least skeptical, if the Gulf states and Oman could maintain independence in view of the revolution sweeping Southern Arabia, and if the fate of the Gulf states would be imperiled. I quote a British passage about President Nasser's expansionist aims. Nasser proclaimed that in most of the affected Middle Eastern states, including the Gulf Sheikhdoms, there were, are, seditious groups ready to go into action when President Nasser gave the signal. And the quote goes on that unless we hold firm in Southern Arabia, the Gulf will be subverted. Now, I'm much aware, of course, that the story can be told from the Arab side as well, and I have been pursuing Arabic, especially in Oman, as a way of understanding British withdrawal from the vantage point of Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt, as well as the individual states or countries. But to make a coherent story this evening, this is my version of the highly complex part of the British side, continuing with this theme of the second transfer of power. There are problems with the...
Okay, well, we'll try to deal with that, and we'll let Roger carry on.
Could you? We momentarily caught a glimpse of Aden and the city port of Aden, known as Aden Town, in which you can see, or did see. It's called North and South Yemen.
Sorry, Roger.
But what I'll do is try to proceed with part of the talk that doesn't have directly to do with the territorial aspects. There we go.
Right,
whoops.
Okay.
There.
Thank you.
So that you can see now, well.
If you just leave it like that,
Yes, that's fine. My idea is that this connects with the idea running through the history of British decolonization of the problems of the transfer of power. And this was an idea put forward at the time, notably by Dennis Healey, the Secretary of State for Defense, that there was a second transfer of power in the 1960s. The first transfer of power, that of the Labour government of Clement Attlee, achieving the first transfer of power, and the second, the Labour government of Harold Wilson in the 1960s, achieving the second. But bear in mind that it was hardly Harold Wilson himself who was responsible for the withdrawal from Southern Arabia and the Gulf. Harold Wilson, at the beginning of his tenure as Prime Minister, described himself as a man of empire, the empire's frontiers or borders stretching to the Himalayas or Himalayas. It was Dennis Healey, as the Defense Secretary, who coined the phrase, the second transfer of power, and he was the principal driving force of decolonization in the Indian Ocean and Southeast Asia, and all the more significant because he saw this as a coherent plan that could actually be called the second transfer of power. But the problem with this concept is that it implies order and a sense of purpose on the part of the British, as if the independence of the colonies had been planned and executed according to the deliberations of the India Office, the Colonial Office, and in the case of the Gulf, the Foreign Office, for the Gulf dependencies were regarded as the western fringe of the Indian Raj. When India became independent in 1947, it was the Foreign Office in the aftermath that took on the supervision or the protection, call it what you will, of the protected states of the Gulf. Protected states, thus entering the imperial vocabulary only in 1948 and excluding Kuwait in the north and Oman in the south. Now, if the concept of the transfer of power implies order and progress, then it is indeed ironic that in the Gulf one has to embrace the opposite meaning of anything but steady and purposeful progress towards independence. On the contrary, almost in every case, it was confusion and uncertain purpose that marked the prelude to withdrawal in 1971. In the case of the Gulf, virtually no one on the British side, until very late in the game, believed that a stable union would be possible, partly because of the differences between the sheikhs themselves, and above all because of the events in the Arabian Peninsula, above all, Aden. I also want to mention, as part of the prelude to my argument, the attitude of the United States, which is relevant, particularly in the earlier years before and immediately after the Second World War, because the Americans had pressed for much earlier independence of the colonies than the British thought possible or desirable. It was the war in Vietnam that changed the American view on British points of security, ranging from Aden to the great naval base at Singapore, but including islands in the Indian Ocean, especially Diego Garcia, or the British Indian Ocean Territory, and later a United States base that became notorious for the removal of the indigenous population to Mauritius and other parts in the Indian Ocean. In other words, in the 1960s, the United States became increasingly dependent for British support, especially in a negative sense. Negative because the Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, refused to commit British soldiers to Vietnam, a point of considerable bitterness on the part of the Americans. I quote a famous exclamation by Dean Rusk, the United States Secretary of State, when he learned of the plan for British withdrawal in 1968 on to 1971. Dean Rusk said that he was profoundly dismayed. I quote, "British withdrawal is a catastrophic loss to human society. These decisions involve the highest judgment, level of judgment and instinct about where the human family is going. We are facing a difficult period in world affairs, and the British are saying that they will not be there." At one point, Rusk reflected on British traditions, British naval and army warfare, and on the British colonial system preparing native peoples for independence. Rusk said, "Good God," hearing the news that the British would withdraw from the Middle East, he said, "Be British." A whole new dimension of Vietnam appeared to be opening up, especially in southern Arabia. Now, Rusk represented American sentiment, and he was especially bitter. On Vietnam, he said to a British reporter, "All we needed was one regiment. The Black Watch would have done. Just one regiment, but you wouldn't." So note Dean Rusk's conclusion, telling a British reporter, "Well, don't expect us to save you again. They can invade Sussex, and we won't do a damned thing about it." So this is the American attitude and background to the British decision to withdraw from Aden and the Gulf. Now, as far as Aden, or the Yemen, was concerned, American knowledge was extremely limited. When President Kennedy was alerted to the danger of civil war, he responded to the question of Aden and Yemen. He said, "I do not even know where they are." In other words, there was not much help to be expected from the Americans to the British dilemmas facing them in the Middle East. Now, the theme of Aden as one of the principal origins of the outcome of withdrawal from the Gulf in 1971 seems to many historians, I would say, to be a neglected dimension, but it has a contemporary significance. The number killed recently in Paris, somewhere in the number, we'll say, of 232, compared with in Aden in 1 year, the number of British and British subjects killed was 1,347 in a single year. By the end of the British era in Aden, the enemies of the British had virtually assassinated all members of the special branch, or the investigative and intelligence branch of the police, while the police force itself had come close to being non-functional. This is one of the reasons why the disintegration of the British position in Aden had a direct bearing on the Gulf. From the mid-60s onwards, Aden, or Yemen in a broader sense, was in the throes of revolution that would, as I've suggested, eventually threaten the Gulf and the Gulf states as well. I'd like to comment just briefly on the stages of the Yemeni revolution, rather through the experience of one of the last of the British dependencies to achieve independence, in other words, Aden in 1967. In this case, it was an anarchic independence. And first of all, when the British referred to Yemeni nationalism as sweeping through that part of the Arabian Peninsula, they distinguished it from the rhetoric of Gamal Abdel Nasser and the aspiration for a united Arab nation in one way or another. In the early 1960s, in Aden, the tribes in the hinterland or the protectorate, you've got to distinguish on the map between Aden, the port city, and the protectorate, or the two protectorates, western and eastern, on the peninsula, in the Arabian peninsula itself. The British believed that the tribes, as they described them, were not necessarily fighting for union with Yemen in the north or in the higher cause of Arab nationalism. They were protesting because against interference with their way of life. It was a way of life dominated, I'm paraphrasing a British minute, by fear and xenophobia, which at least was not the nationalism of Nasser and Egypt. But there did develop politically and in a popular way the idea that there should be no north and no south, but one Yemen, including all of British Aden, the two protectorates in the Aden port town. I quote from a British assessment, the nationalist side, quote, there is to be one Yemen, the occupied part of which must be liberated. So the demand for independence put forward by radical Yemeni and Adeni nationalists gained momentum, thus becoming eventually a nationalist movement supported by Egypt. And it extended throughout the southern Arabian Peninsula and eventually included, in British estimates, the danger to Oman and the Gulf states. Now, on the British side, there were two views about the future of Aden. One was put forward by Sir William Luce, one of the last of the great British proconsuls, and the other by Julian Amory, who in the 1950s served at the Colonial Office. This is Julian Amory, the son of Leopold Amory, who had been Colonial Secretary, Secretary of State for India, and so on. Julian's brother had been hanged for high treason at the end of the Second World War, which perhaps increased his own sense of patriotism. Julian Amory followed in his father's footsteps to maintain both the physical presence and the prestige of the British Empire worldwide. In the case of Aden, for example, Julian Amory believed that the port city of Aden should remain a permanent and sovereign British base in order to protect the Gulf. He believed that the British should continue to occupy the base at Aden as a city port and military garrison despite an anarchic or hostile hinterland. The Aden colony would be, I quote, a Gibraltar, protecting other vital British dependencies, including the protected states in the Gulf. Amory believed, in other words, that the port of Aden, the part of Aden that was a crown colony and known as Aden Town, could be effectively defended. And to hell with the rest of the world, he said. The notion of a harder, tougher empire united by strategic bases in the Indian Ocean, to Julian Amory, was a compelling thought. But this was a controversial subject. Amory found himself on the losing side in the Colonial Office and in the Air Ministry, which I mentioned because Amory moved from the Colonial Office to the Air Ministry and from there helped to mobilize through the British Secret Service, or MI6, a British mercenary group attempting to tilt the Yemeni revolution in Britain's favor. Now, I'm anticipating the story of the revolution itself, but it appeared entirely possible that at this time, in the early 1960s, that the empire would survive in one form or another, and if Julian Amory had had his way, the empire would continue to the present, with its commanding positions at Aden and Singapore and a predominant British area of influence in the region of the Indian Ocean and particularly the Gulf. In the event, it was the traditional colonial office view that won out. This was the alternative outlook put forward by Sir William Luce, who had served in the Sudan and was fluent in Arabic. He believed that unless the British could put together a coherent plan for Aden and the Gulf, then the British would face a head-on collision with the Arabs of southern Arabia. This was the philosophical basis, indeed the basis of British colonial office philosophy itself, as presented in the dual mandate of Lord Lugard, that Britain could not remain in Aden against the will of the peoples of southern Arabia, and that every effort must be made to grant independence to a larger federated Aden embracing the protectorates in the hinterland. Now, ironically, Nasser at one point said that all that we, the Egyptians, the Arabs are doing in the Yemen, the northern Aden, is the same thing that Lord Lugard was doing in northern Nigeria. In other words, helping the peoples of Nigeria, the subjected peoples, to stand on their own as an independent unit. Now, this was, as you can see, an exceedingly complex problem because in the north, in 1962, a revolutionary Republican coup had overthrown the Iman of Yemen, and thus beginning the Yemeni civil war that would extend to Aden, which on the map is now called South Yemen. Or on this map, it's both north and south, South Yemen, and extending to Oman and the states in the Gulf. Now, bear in mind that in the 1960s, Gamal Abdel Nasser was riding high after the Allied defeat at Suez. And to unite all Arab peoples through the wave of Arab nationalism, his goal was that in Yemen and Aden, they had a particular technological dimension. And he had in mind the era of the transistor radios, which every day broadcast the voice of the Arabs and Nasser's passionate denunciations of the British in Aden and throughout the entire region. Nasser's Cairo radio far surpassed British broadcasts. British broadcasts had the problem of trying to make the local people think in terms of a democratic, centralized federal government, while historically and traditionally they had thought in terms of tribal and clan authority. Nasser aimed for the development of a sense of Yemeni nationalism as a part of the larger movement for Arab unity. Egypt, to demonstrate the importance to which Nasser attached to all of this, Egypt committed 70,000 troops to the civil war in Yemen, the civil war aimed at the overthrow of the British in the southern part of the peninsula, Aden and Aden Town. These were Egyptian troops that were attested by the time of the British as possessing chemical weapons. Now, this was one-third of the Egyptian army, and parenthetically, a disaster for Egypt because in the 1967 war with Israel, Nasser still had 70,000 troops, Egyptian troops, one-third of the Egyptian army pinned down in Yemen. Southern Arabia in the 1960s was thus a revolutionary part of the world. In the north, the royalist regime, with the assistance of British mercenaries, headed by Billy McLean, with the guidance of Julian Amery, and through MI6 and the connection with the Colonial Office and Air Ministry, attempted, the British were attempting to hold their own against a revolutionary force that the British believed to be supported by the Soviet Union on the basis of equipment found during the course of the campaign. So bear in mind that we are talking about a period at the height of the Cold War when Southern Arabia seemed to face the danger of becoming a Soviet satellite or at least a region under Soviet control. Now these ideas seem today to be rather exaggerated, but even to so level-headed a person as Ralph Bunche at the United Nations, he commented at one point that Yemen could become a Cuba in the Middle East. Well, the British response was based on the British colonial tradition that had been tested and found sound in colonies throughout the world. I have mentioned Sir William Luce, who represented the opposite view from Julian Amory and others I have mentioned, with Sir William Luce believing that Britain could not rule Aden without the consent of the people of Aden, and that eventual independence meant working with them to establish representative institutions, cooperation, collaboration with their leaders. The plan was thus to create a federation of the colony, the crown colony of Aden, the port city called Aden Town, with the hinterland, which was a vast area, as you can see from the map, extending to Yemen in the north and east, and encompassing an area the size of the United Kingdom itself, or to put it another way, half the size of Texas. In other words, a vast area. The creation of the Federation in the early 1960s took place at a time when comparable federations in the West Indies, Central Africa, had either collapsed or were on the brink of dissolution. Now, the aim was admirable. It made geographical, economic, and administrative sense for the resources of the hinterland to be developed on the basis of the vibrant economy of the port city, and the port city itself to have a hinterland to develop rather than to achieve eventual independence on the model of the city's port itself, on the model of Singapore as a city-state. This was the idea that Aden would become, might become the equivalent of Singapore. So the pooling of resources of Aden Town, the city, the crown colony of Aden, with the hinterland would allow the financing of large-scale development. But this idea, the federation, had severe problems from the very beginning. In the 1960s, the early 1960s, it was apathy rather than protest that marked the actual merger, but common people, everyday people in the back streets of Aden Town sensed that the Federation would work to the advantage of the sheikhs and the rich merchants. There was a hostile reactionary from revolutionary Yemen in the north, Egypt, and the world generally. Now the hero of the story, if such he can be called, was Sir Gerald Trevascus, who forged the Federation of Aden Town and the two protectorates in the hinterland. In a few words, the description of Aden Town, his own words, the crown colony off the coast of the Arabian Peninsula, analogous to Singapore, had emerged by the 1950s as a major maritime bunkering port servicing more traffic than any other port in the world except New York. Aden Town, in other words, would have been immediately recognizable to any visitor as a British colonial city. The immigrant workers created the impression of a volatile urban society, but the British community of soldiers, civil servants, refinery technicians, agricultural advisors, irrigation engineers, doctors, teachers. They all gave an equally strong impression of a dependency conforming to the classic traditions of the British colonial presence. The underlying assumption was that everyone would benefit from the prosperity of the city port. The greater the economic boom, the greater the chance for an enduring connection between Britain and the city port and the hinterland. Now, in the hinterland, and this was the phrase used to describe the protectorates, was the oil refinery at Little Aden, which I'm afraid is not marked on the map, but it is about 20 miles north and east of Aden town. Little Aden had been constructed in 1952 after Mohammad Mossadegh had evicted the Anglo-Iranian oil company from Iran. Little Aden was the most important oil installation in the region. Near it, Kosmaskar Airfield was the Royal Air Force's busiest station. The base itself, near Little Aden and about 20 miles from the port city, the development of the Royal Air Force base represented a military commitment as large as any post-war British government had undertaken. In the protectorate itself, indirect rule, as in Fiji, Malaya, and Nigeria, found its origins in treaties with individual rulers and sheikhs. The hope was that a federation of the sheikhs would stabilize the hinterland against the challenge of growing radical Arab nationalism. But federation never achieved a political identity. Travascus, who was the architect of all of this, the principal architect, hoped to forge a viable structure that would be autonomous in its individual tribal units, but united under British patronage and protection. During the tenure of Gerald Travascus, the British made improvements in agriculture and communications and provided significant economic, educational, and medical services in the hinterland. The Protectorate's federation, however, remained a conglomeration of individuals and groups united only because of the fear of common enemies. Critics often applied the word feudal to the attempt by Travascus and others to shore up traditional authority, thereby leaving the rulers almost as absolute as before. Harold Macmillan, at the beginning of all of this, had a gift for improbable comparisons, had compared the tribesmen to the Scottish Highlanders of earlier centuries. "They are on our side," Macmillan wrote of the sheikhs, or so he hoped. By securing the cooperation of the sheikhs in the hinterland, Nasser might be foiled and the position of the base secured in perpetuity and as a possible, against a possible bid for Soviet supremacy in the region. In fact, the Protectorate's federation remained a conglomeration of individuals and groups united only by a fear of common enemies, but inspired by the wave of Arab nationalism. British Aden was regarded by other nations, especially at the United Nations, as one of the most significant remnants of European imperialism. Aden's prisons, or jails, I quote, "are worse than Hitler's camps." There was, in the mid-1960s, an official inquiry made by the British in response to these allegations, and concluded that there were, the British official inquiry concluded that there was no basis for the allegations of torture. But High Commissioner was Sir Gerald Turnbull, who had previously served in Kenya. And so he was especially aware and concerned with the problems of torture. But the official commission did acknowledge that when people were jailed, that they were forced to stand with fingers edged against the wall for long periods of time, from 12 to 24 hours. And this does create a sense of deorientation, among other problems, and yet this was not classified as torture or persecution, though Turnbull himself acknowledged that it came pretty close to it. The point of all of this is that by 1967, the British felt beleaguered and surrounded by a terrorist insurrection. The Yemeni revolution was in full swing, along with a growing skepticism in London whether the colony was worth the cost of British lives. Dennis Healy, the Defense Secretary, along with the Foreign Secretary, George Brown, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Roy Jenkins, formed an alliance in the cabinet in favor of cutting ties with this derelict colony, despite the danger that might be involved with the protection of the Gulf states. Healy was especially insistent that Britain needed to end its connection with all overseas territories. And the explanation, in part, is that the economic blizzard that had swept over Britain in the mid-1960s, when unemployment stood at a higher level at any time since 1945, and inflation rising to unprecedented heights, Healy thought that this meant that the end has come with the overseas commitments, if only for economic reasons. He compared the defense expenditures, in fact, to a runaway train. Roy Jenkins, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1967, made the critical difference in the outcome because Jenkins believed that the remnants of empire, such as Aden, should be liquidated and that Britain should move towards the European community. In the meantime, Aden had become ungovernable, and in the view of the civil war in southern Arabia, the cabinet decided that British rule would end in 1968. And what would the consequences be for the Gulf? In intensity, anti-colonial sentiment resembled that of the Algerian Revolution. Rival factions battled for control of the streets in Aden, and in the different factions vying for power, no one could be any less nationalist than the other. November 1967, the last of British troops were lifted by helicopter to a naval task force in the harbor. It was described at the time as a scuttle. In any event, the military collapse brought to a close 129 years of British rule in Aden. And for the British, it marked the end of the great game in Western Asia. And still, the question arose, what of the protection of the states in the Gulf? And this is the climax to the story. The Yemeni revolution moved eastwards and northwards towards Oman and the Gulf states at the same time that the British had announced in a very confused fashion that they would withdraw from the Gulf states in 1971. The situation now became urgent and led to intense, indeed frantic, discussions on how best to create a security structure after the British departure from the Gulf. As the plan emerged, the former Trucial states would merge into a new United Arab Emirates, which actually happened, as the result of intense discussions with each of the rulers, who in some cases even offered to pay for the continued British presence. But the merger also succeeded because of the recognition of the rulers themselves in the Gulf that it was in their own self-interest to unite, thus erecting a defense against possible predators, including Iran and Saudi Arabia. British sway, British influence, however, had by no means ceased to exist. By withdrawing from the protected states, the formal British presence disappeared, but informal influence remained. To demonstrate this point, look briefly at the circumstances of the protected states, the United Arab Emirates themselves. In wealth and prosperity, Abu Dhabi and Dubai belong to a class of their own. The remaining kingdoms were sometimes known as the Dissident Five, not merely because of their lack of wealth, but also because they came close to accepting aid and support by the Arab League, and thus with it, unremitting hostility to the British. The Union was thus precarious, not only for internal reasons, but also because of the danger of the Yemeni revolution. So the collapse of British position in Aden was of exceptional significance for the Gulf states and also Oman. And in some respects, Oman was exceptional. Oman was not one of the British protected states, in other words, not one of the protected states from which the British withdrew in 1971. Oman had its own, had maintained its own independence. The British might exercise a certain informal control, but to the world at large and in international law, Oman existed as an independent state. So with the rest of the empire, the British Empire ceasing to exist, for the most part in the 1960s, Oman became all the more important as a staging point on to Hong Kong and the dominions of Australia and New Zealand. Oman thus acquired an importance that would have come to as a surprise to those of a previous generation. One might ask the question, what then was the nature of the British presence in Oman, since Oman was independent and ruled by its own sultan, who at the time was Sultan Timur, who had ruled since the 1930s. There were, in fact, several components to British involvement. One was that of the oil industry. The second was that of the military, an army dominated by British soldiers, seconded from their units. And the last was political. The British were in Oman with the agreement of the Sultan. British military assistance provided the overall security of the Omani state. In return, the Sultan had to acknowledge a degree over Omani finance. An interference with the economic structure of Oman was the one thing that the Sultan Timur resented the most. He was virtually obsessed with financial accounts and audited records, and to his credit, as the British acknowledged, he had managed to bring economic stability to Oman over a period of decades, though at the expense of public projects such as agricultural development, schools, and such things as water purification. Solvency, in other words, came at a cost. The Sultan of Oman balanced his budget, trying not to spend more than he had, and in this particular way, he achieved success even before the oil revenues began to bolster Oman's economy. But the Sultan refused to accept proposals for extending such things as medical and veterinary services to Dhofar, the province in the west and south. The Sultan of Oman had nothing but contempt for the hearts and minds solutions of the 1960s. He resented British suggestions that he should support projects of public welfare, which he believed might lead to Oman insolvency. Such was the Sultan's growing resentment of British attempts to control Oman that the Sultan surrounded his castle with barbed wire and gave orders to shoot on sight anyone attempting to leave or enter without his permission. Yet there was insurgency in the province of Dhofar, which from another point of view is the eastern tip of the Yemeni revolution. The insurgency in Dhofar thus became ever more serious, making it more plausible than ever that the Yemeni rebels would triumph. The critical point came in July 1970, the same point when things were coming to a head in the Gulf States, when the British, in a military assistance, drew the conclusion that the armed forces of Oman would have to be significantly increased or faced the prospect of defeat in Dhofar, indeed Oman itself, and probably the Gulf States. The insurgency had now reached international significance. The supply from Yemen to Dhofar was named after Ho Chi Minh. And the British found actual evidence of Chinese assistance to the rebel forces. At a critical time in the war in Vietnam, Dhofar now threatened to be another major setback for the West. Now, the Sultan of Oman proved to be uncooperative with the British, with plans for meeting the insurgency with sufficient force. The British now viewed him as a, quote, a dangerous anachronism. In 1970, the British became directly responsible for his overthrow and his replacement by his son Qaboos, ruler of Oman to the present. Qaboos had been trained at the Royal Military Academy in Sandhurst. He was his own man, but he saw the danger of the Yemeni revolution sweeping eastwards and northwards through Dhofar to the heart of Oman itself, and from there, so feared the British, to the states of the Gulf. So the British took very seriously what they believed to be the rebellion's aim, to destroy all of the dynastic regimes in the Gulf. By strengthening the Omani forces in Dhofar, the Omani army, with critical British support, eventually subdued the rebellion along the lines, as you see, the western and southern boundary of Oman on the map. By strengthening the Omani surface forces, the British held the line along the present western border of Oman. Now, the British did assist decisively in the creation of the United Arab Emirates and in withdrawing formal British military and political protection. In other words, the Gulf was no longer a British lake, but Oman was the exception to the withdrawal of all British troops east of Suez. And in a later era, both United States and British forces made use of bases in Oman before and during the Gulf War of 1990-91. And to the present, Oman remains important for U.S. and British operations. At the close of the 20th century, there were over 500 British military, air, and naval personnel seconded or contracted to Oman's forces. Training operations had evolved over 6,000 British troops. The British presence in the Gulf might be less visible in Oman throughout the Gulf in the pre-1971 era, but it was and is nevertheless real and significant. So to be clear, about the meaning of the British military presence in Oman in the early 1970s, the British themselves were firm in the belief that they had held the line against the Yemeni revolution, thus saving the Gulf states. And thus ended a chapter in the Gulf's history, with Oman receiving critical British assistance in defeating the radical Arab world, above all Nasser's Egypt, to capture the aims of Nasser to capture the wealth of the Gulf. Now, Nasser, of course, died in 1970, a date that has symbolic meaning for the Arab nationalism, the continued British presence in Oman, and the security of the Gulf states. In a more or less national or British perspective, British economic and military power since the time of the withdrawal from the Gulf in 1971 has been fundamentally different from that of the imperial system that had existed in the Middle East since the First World War. In 1945, the British still hoped to remain dominant in the region by dismantling the old empire and by developing the Middle East in partnership with Arab nationalism. The Suez Crisis of 1956 shattered that vision, and the disintegration of the British position in Aden in 1967 marked the end of the formal British presence in the Middle East. The collapse of Aden represented the nadir of popularity of the British Empire. In London and throughout the United Kingdom, the British Empire was never so unpopular as in the year 1967. The last shades of red seemed to have vanished on the map, and it seemed to be a clear ending. But in 1971, new national embassies arrived in what previously had been described as a British preserve, a British lake. The Gulf states were freed from the Sterling area in the 1970s and the 1980s. It seemed that Iran and then Saudi Arabia might emerge as the successor to Britain as the predominant power in the Gulf. At the time, the role of the United States was by no means entirely clear. But times of crisis sometimes reveal a new configuration of power. And as in 1956, with the British collapse at Suez, of course it is debatable, but in view of the Gulf War of 1991 and other events, it seems that the true successor, the real successor to the British Empire in the Middle East is, for better or worse, the United States. But the British legacy, cultural as well as political, endures throughout the region, in Oman and Kuwait, as well as in the United Arab Emirates. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Roger. We have some time for questions, and the stewards have roving mics. Could I just ask you, please, when you ask a question, to give your name, your affiliation, and please remember that a question ends with a question mark. Yes, gentlemen here.
Thank you very much. You mentioned the United Arab Emirates, and I think, it seems to be one of the most successful creations of that era, and could you just say something about what your view of the present situation of human rights in the Emirates? Is it good, or are there many problems, and its overall foreign policy? I've had something to do with the Emirates in the past, so I'm very interested to know your views.
Well, that, in fact, is a rather complicated question, and I'm sure that you know the answers in some parts of the questions better than I. In fact, the United Arab Emirates is regarded as one of the last great success stories to the liquidation of the British Empire, comparable perhaps to Malaysia and the story of Singapore. As for the stability and as for the interior reception of protests against human rights, this is another question. And the sultans themselves have been rather less than favorable in receiving protests about immigrant workers against general conditions in the state, even though they have been voiced in the United Nations. But the rulers of the Emirates remain very much insistent that they are the rulers of their own kingdoms.
Yes. Other questions? Yes, a gentleman at the back there.
Hello, Nigel Davis. That's very interesting. Thank you. Could you expand, please, a bit more on Julian Amory's plan, which wasn't successful? And was there anything from that that was used in the subsequent coup of the Sultan of Oman?
Well, the broad lines of Julian Amory's design for the rest of the world was that the British Empire would continue to exist, as I mentioned, to the present. In other words, that there would be permanent British bases, as in Singapore, as in Aden. Now, Amory was not so much involved in the latter part of the story, in other words, from 1970-71, except indirectly through MI6, and they continued to play a very important part in the story, but this is a part of the story that remains unknown, because MI6, unlike the American CIA, refuses to release any of its records. It could be that this is a good thing, and there are a lot of problems on the American side, but the CIA records do reveal the nature of the British assistance to the states in 1971 and beyond.
Yes, gentlemen here.
I think the British have been a very malign force in the whole of Saudi Arabia, Gulf states, and as such. The overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, for instance, and the possession of the oil. This has left legacy even now with the situation happening in the Gulf state as well as in ISIS. I think the genesis of ISIS can be traced back to the failure of a British playing a very dirty role, malign role, in colonial history. And the human rights violation in Aden is very well known, just as in case of Singapore as such. And it's a sad thing that Julian Emery and those colonialists, they thought that British Empire will last forever. And I think have played, there is no enlightenment.
If you could come to a question, that would be great.
So my question is that can you trace the problem now happening on ISIS and the failure? It is stemming from that malign role way back in the 50s and 60s and 70s.
Well, that's a very stimulating idea, and I haven't actually thought of the connection between Mossadegh and the nationalization of the oil company and the problems in the Gulf. We do have the authority on Mossadegh and Iran, and Raj Barzagardi is here, and he can answer that question better than I. I think, on the whole, the question of British exploitation through oil, on the whole, the British were disappointed. Because they drill holes for oil in the Gulf states and in Oman and found dry holes, and it was the Shell Oil Company that became the dominant industry in the region. Now, as for the connection between the ISIS and the events of the 1960s and the 1970s, I'm not sure. So, I hadn't really thought of the connection before, but thank you. I'll try to sort this out in my own mind. Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Other questions? Yes, Professor Stevenson.
Yeah. Can you tell us more about the influence? Sorry, the question is, can you tell us any more about the influence of any of the British internal politics at the period? I'm thinking of two things in particular. One is, was there internal debate or dissension within the Labour Party? And also, what degree of continuity was there between Harold Wilson and Ted Heath's governments?
Well, it was certainly the combination of Dennis Healey and Roy Jenkins, and to some extent George Brown, though he was rather an erratic personality or a part of the trio, that was decisive in the decision actually to sever the links, in other words, to bring about the withdrawal of all forces east of Suez. And it wasn't so much a question of dissent or controversy at the time in relation to the economic problems of the 1960s. These were the things that were really of predominant importance at the time in which the withdrawal from Aden and other parts of the world were seen as even a minor way of reducing the problem of economic dependency and debt and the future of the United Kingdom itself. It was a time, as you know, of great debate of the future of the United Kingdom, whether it was in preserving what was left of the British Empire, and that was given a negative answer, but the other alternative was the entry into Europe, and that is where the great division came, and I think still does to the present. But it was certainly Dennis Healey who was the driving force behind all of this.
Any other questions? Just trying to see. Roger, it is not normal for the women of LSE to be so quiet. Yeah, please.
Did any of the new states in the Gulf eventually join the Commonwealth?
No. At least to my knowledge, one of the remarkable things about the entire Middle East, extending all the way to the Sudan, is that there's no membership in the Commonwealth. It's just a remarkable feature of the Commonwealth at large that the Middle East is a missing component. There may be minor exceptions, but in the rule, that's the story.
Other questions? My goodness. Wow. Very well. There's a gentleman over here at the far side.
Thanks. Just wondering if you can, is it possible to tie what's going on in Yemen at the moment to the historical position and whether you think a more rapid withdrawal of the British at the time would have had a different outcome long term?
No, and in relation to the question that the Indian gentleman asked me, I think this is a very engaging issue, and I don't myself see the direct connection. It could be that there is one, but I leave it to others to make the explanation.
Any more? Yes, gentlemen.
Jonathan Mueller, just an interested member of the public. I'm a little surprised that you don't make any mention of the 1967 Sterling crisis and the budget reduction, since that came after that, because that's usually seen as the trigger for the decision to leave east of Suez.
Oh, yes, overriding. And I failed to acknowledge, perhaps, the significance of the overall economic problems of the British in the 1960s, and in 1967, of course, it was the Arab-Israeli war that added a dimension to all of this, and the one of the problems for the British was what was called the big lie, that the British had provided assistance to the Israelis. Otherwise, how could you have such a devastating defeat of the Arab forces in 1967. So 1967 is a very, very critical point, not only for the economic part of the story, but also because of the larger configuration of problems in the Middle East, not least the confrontation between Israel and the Arab states.
Yes, Dr. Lewis.
I'm only asking this because of your challenge to LSE women. I was very interested to see Julian Amory having a part here, and as we know, he famously told Harriet Macmillan before he gave the Wind of Change speech that it was the worst speech he'd ever heard and he shouldn't give it. He had a reputation for being a bit of a buffoon, even amongst his own party. Do you think that that carried on into this period and that he was dismissed because of his previous record? Did you find it quite surprising he was in this role? And my second question would be, how far do you see the royal family as having a role here as a cultural tool, perhaps in greater proportion than in other parts of decolonizations? Thank you.
My answer to the part of Julian Emery is that, of course, he did have the that image in part of being a buffoon, but he was a very serious person and considered as the key spokesman on imperial and defense issues. In other words, he was following in his father's footsteps of trying to maintain the prestige and authority of the British Empire. As for the royal family, the significance in the Middle East is much less than it is in other parts of the world.
Yes, Sarah, yes.
Try to wind it up now.
Might I ask two questions? Just
go right ahead.
Okay. So the first one is, there's debate in the historiography surrounding the British withdrawal east of Suez, particularly with regards to the formation of the UAE, on the question on whether the Shah of Iran was offered a secret agreement to give up Bahrain in exchange for the Abu Musa and the Tan Islands, and I just wondering what your thoughts on that was. And the second question is, in your article on the plot to overthrow Mossadegh, you talked about how MI6 hasn't really declassified a lot of documents, and there was this work produced by this book produced by I think C.M. Woodhouse, I think it was. Was that correct?
Monty Woodhouse.
Oh yes. Yes,
where he it's just remarkable in that it would be very, very odd to see a book disclosing such information produced today or even 10 or 15 years ago. So I'm just curious about how that came about.
Thank you, Simon.
Yes, I'm sorry. The first point of the question was
the controversy over whether there was a quid pro quo with Iran for Bahrain.
The Shah, of course, was very much involved in all of this, and especially in the question of Bahrain and the islands that were still disputed between the United Arab Emirates and Iran, and it was in part because of the skill of the British diplomats in the region later by Dennis Wright that helped to resolve all of this, in large part because of the persuasive powers of the British on the Shah at the time. The latter part of the question, I'm sure.
Well, do you think there was a quid pro quo, I think is what he's asking.
Sorry, between?
Well, in the sense that whether the British made some kind of promise to the Shah that if he dropped his claim to Bahrain, he would then be able to take the islands.
I'm not sure of that. You would know better than I.
I defer to you, Roger. and then I think the other question was on Monty Woodhouse's memoirs.
Oh, Monty Woodhouse. Well, Monty Woodhouse was quite an exceptional figure in any case, in the Greek Civil War and so on. So he had an independence of mind. He was quite decisive in the formulation of plans about Mossadegh and the Iranian oil question and so on. So when he came back, he saw that no reason for him not to write a book about it, which was in defiance of MI6. And so he said that he was reprimanded. He said that a beautiful young woman was sent around to tell him that he shouldn't have done this. And he said, thank you, and I'll not do it again.
All right. Well, I think that's a good note on which to end things. So please join me in thanking you.